No vessel, however well constructed, could take that punishment. Like a wounded animal in her death throes, she dipped slowly into the black waters of the fjord, her stern guardrails disappearing as she settled deeper and deeper to roll wearily onto her side. Then, stern first, she slid down and down below the level of the sea, leaving only a maelstrom of swirling ripples on the surface, dotted with the bobbing heads of men calling wildly as they thrashed about in the ice-cold water. To attempt rescue would be to invite disaster, for more shells were falling on and around Hotspur. By now, the remaining two British destroyers, Hostile and Havoc, 2 miles ahead of the withdrawal, raced back and engaged the German ships at close range, scoring direct hits on their forward turrets. Battered by the accurate shooting of the British, the Germans withdrew and allowed Hotspur, shepherded by Hostile and Havoc, to proceed down Offutt Fjord. To return to Hardy, Stanning was left with no other option than to give the order abandon ship. The fire was spreading, and to give a chance of survival to the crew by running the ship aground, he set his course for a nearby beach under the cliffs. As the ship shuddered to a halt, only 200 yards from the shore, many of the crew who remained alive jumped overboard and began to swim towards the beach, while behind them, Hardy lay ablaze in the calm waters. The exhausted survivors, carrying their wounded, scrambled up the cliff face through the deep snow to a crowd of Norwegians who had rushed from their houses to help them. In the distance, half a mile or so away from the spot where they had scrambled ashore after swimming and wading some hundreds of yards under fire, the heroes of this hard-fought battle saw a little group of wooden houses. Slowly, the half-frozen men, many of whom had thrown off their heavy coats before plunging into the water, and some so sorely wounded that they would have fallen but for the supporting arms of their comrades, staggered through the snow. Some 80 of them presented themselves at the home of a Mrs. Christensen and her daughter. They welcomed them and did everything possible for the unexpected visitors. Surgeon Wayne, who, although himself wounded, did what he could for the many wounded, the bearing of whom was very courageous. Particularly was this so in the case of able seaman Bailey, who, half frozen with cold and with one hand shot off, sat for 1.5 hours and never once murmured. 15 miles away, connected by a very rough road, was the little township of Ballinger, held by Norwegian troops and possessing a hospital. From thence, an ambulance was obtained, which took the more serious cases, the wounded who could not be accommodated, and they were lashed to a sledge. The others trudged along as best they could. During the journey, made more painful by the condition of the track, the party met the crew of the British steamer North Cornwall, which the Germans had captured. They had been removed and placed on board the whaling ship Jan Willem, but during the battle were put on shore under guards, from whom they escaped. Having joined up the little party, they entered the town together, a torn and tattered band of British seamen who had fought and only just escaped the Nazi prison camps. On the bridge of Hardy, Warburton Lee, his body torn by shrapnel, was still alive but unconscious. Willing hands carefully lifted him and managed to carry him to the side of the burning ship, where he was placed on a raft, and there, by dint of paddling and pushing, they reached the shore, only to find that their captain was already dead. For Warburton Lee and all those who died on that fateful day, it was indeed a sad end to an enterprise which, at first, had all the hallmarks of success, but through miscalculation of the enemy's strength, based on incorrect information, led to the loss of 2 of Britain's valuable destroyers and many of their crews. But it was not the end of the story, for as the 3 surviving British ships raced through Offutt Fjord towards the estuary, they encountered a German ammunition ship, the Rhônefels, making its way up through the fjord in a bid to supplement the exhausted supplies of the invasion forces at Narvik. Having challenged there, they then opened fire on the vessel, which immediately burst into flame. Loaded with cordite, shells, and depth charges, the Rhônefels blew up with a massive eruption of red flame and orange-coloured smoke billowing hundreds of feet high. There were few survivors. Of the German destroyers, two had been sunk, two had been seriously damaged, and four others slightly damaged. That same day, after a thorough assessment of the situation, Captain Erich Bey, the senior surviving officer, was ordered by German Naval Command to attempt a breakout with the only two seaworthy destroyers. That evening, the Erich Geiss and the Wolfgang Zenker set out from Narvik in a bid to reach the sea and to return to Germany. But by the time they reached the position off Tranøy, the pilot station in Vestfjord, some 50 miles to the west, they sighted in the fading light of the evening the silhouette of a patrolling British cruiser and two destroyers. Convinced that the clear visibility made a breakout impossible, Bay turned back and returned to Narvik. Unless the weather deteriorated to allow another attempt to escape, his force was trapped. The situation remained unchanged throughout the 11th, but on the 12th, the British made an attack on the remaining destroyers, which Bay had carefully distributed inside fjords, with a formation of torpedo-carrying swordfish launched from the distant patrolling aircraft carrier Furious. The raid was a failure, with the loss of two aircraft. Bay soon realized that not only was escape impossible, but that the British would soon launch a further attack to destroy his surviving ships. For some reason, the Admiralty had come to the conclusion, incorrectly as it proved, that apart from the remaining German destroyers, there were also two cruisers, and decided that a battleship should be used to attack them. As a result, Vice Admiral Whitworth transferred his flag from the battle cruiser Renown to the battleship Warspite, and with nine destroyers, preceded by more aircraft from Furious, entered Offutt Fjord to attack the remaining ships. The British destroyers, led by Hero, spread their approach across the fjord, guns and torpedoes at the ready. The first German casualty was the submarine U-64, which was attacked and sunk by Warspite's aircraft. By early afternoon, battle had been joined, with five mobile German destroyers facing the British force, firing their torpedoes in an attempt to sink Warspite. In the smoke and flame of the ensuing engagement, both sides were firing at their greatest effect and navigating their ships at maximum maneuverability. But the Germans, heavily outmatched, stood no chance against the 15-inch guns of Warspite, the thunder of which reverberated around the mountains of Offutfjord like the voice of judgment. Overwhelmed by the British force, Bay ordered withdrawal into Rombak's Fjord. Now short of ammunition, the German ships attempted to run themselves ashore to allow their crews to escape, but pursued by the destroyer Eskimo, were either torpedoed and sunk, or were scuttled and sunk by their own men. The Eskimo, despite being hit in the bows by a stray torpedo, survived, and was able to withdraw later with the British squadron. The fight had started at 12:26 p.m. By 1:45 p.m., when Warspite and the destroyers were bombarding the land batteries, the battle had become a series of running actions, and by 2:30, three of the Germans were accounted for. A fourth, badly hit, steamed up Rombak's Fjord with three more, which flung smoke floats overboard to elude the five warships, which gave chase and sank them. At the end of the day, seven Nazi destroyers had been accounted for and the shore batteries destroyed. Three British destroyers had been damaged. So it came about that Bay's destroyers, which had survived Warburton Lee's attack on his invasion force, were all sunk or wrecked without the loss of a single British ship. Following the withdrawal, two British destroyers were left off Narvik to observe events, and one of these succeeded in rescuing the survivors of Warburton Lee's Hardy, who had, in the meantime, managed to maintain themselves on shore. In the following days and weeks, the Germans, by a combination of ruthlessness, boldness, and valor, gained control of all Norway, including vital airfields along the western and northern seaboard, from which German bombers and fighters were soon operating. By 1941, they had also established submarine bases and heavy surface ship bases from which they were able to attack and seriously threaten the lifeline of supplies to North Russia. But in this initial invasion against the neutral country, he received a serious setback with the loss of some of his biggest and best destroyers. So ended the Battle of Narvik. While Warburton Lee's bold and courageous incursion into a fjord in a surprise attempt to defeat the invasion fleet may have been considered rash, the action itself cultivated a constant fear in Hitler's mind throughout World War II that Britain would one day launch an invasion to retake Norway. That nagging fear compelled him to maintain a considerable force of his navy, army, and air force there, which might have been used to better effect in his other campaigns in Europe. For his valor and enterprise, Captain Warburton Lee was posthumously awarded the Victoria Cross. Born in Shropshire in 1895 and trained at the Royal Naval Britannia College at Dartmouth, his talents and aptitudes were soon recognized when he became head of his term in 1912 and a midshipman a year later. He died at the age of 45.